Hello, and welcome to another episode of Tactical Startup. This week, we're going to be talking to Jason Burkhead. And he is a former military police officer who switched over to criminal defense. He has had numerous cases, some of which, including a federal case involving fentanyl, importation charge, where he was able to get the client into a federal military diversion, which is pretty impressive. In his, a couple of his state cases, he's had numerous charges and warrant for his client, and the client didn't even know about it. So he was able to convince the prosecutor to dismiss all charges without having to take the case past a readiness conference. I'm excited to have him on here because he's beginning his journey as an entrepreneur and business owner, and so he's going to be able to share a unique perspective on what it takes to get started in something as competitive as criminal defense. Because let me tell you, it is very competitive in criminal defense. So I'm excited to have him on here, and let's get to it, shall we? You're listening to Tactical Startup, a podcast dedicated to building amazing businesses. I'm your host, Taylor Darcy. In this podcast, we explore ways to innovate, improve, and level up your business through sales, marketing, automation, and business planning. Successful businesses pivot when times are bad and stay the course when times are good. We will have guests from different walks of life to help you see that success is not only possible, but even probable, no matter when or where you start. Through hard work and strategic planning, you can have the entrepreneurial life you've always dreamed. Tune in weekly to level up your business. Jason, welcome. How are you today?
Taylor, good afternoon. I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing good, doing good. So let's jump right in as far as, like, you wear many different hats as a criminal defense attorney. What prompted moving from military police to criminal defense? I know that's one of those ones where, like, most people would think about going as a prosecutor, not as a criminal defense. So tell me about that. Why make that choice?
Okay, a shorter version of a way longer story. As you said in my intro, that I was a military police in the Air Force for 20 years. A lot of that time I was a supervisor. As I went on in my career, I started seeing where patrolmen were taking shortcuts and trying to write around things in the reports. And ultimately, there may or may not have been rights compromises. And when I kind of tried to say something about it, I was shushed. I was kind of sidelined. And that was really what pushed me to go into law school following when I retired from the military. I always had that teenage dream of, hey, I want to be a lawyer when I grow up. I just happen to have to go through 20 years of the military to grow up enough. My experience as a cop, largely good. And what I saw is it was a small number, but they could do the most damage. And that's really what pushed me into criminal defense.
Okay. So I'd like to think of criminal defense as keeping this in a system honest, right? Like that's, you're ensuring or helping to ensure the integrity of the system, especially when it comes to people being deprived of their rights. And that's such an important part of becoming of a truly just system, right? Like we're only prosecuting people that, or we should be only prosecuting people that we have the correct evidence for. Am I accurate in that?
You are. And really there's a general misconception about criminal defense, and it comes from all the TV shows. It's not always about getting the client out of all charges. It is making that landing, however that landing is, as comfortable as possible. You know, you have cases where people are internally know they're guilty. They're not expecting to get out of things. They're expecting to get the most comfortable outcome they can deal with. Sure. And that's, you know, that's really the difference there. It's not always the Perry Mason, hey, I found this one thing and you get to walk free now.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, media is terrible about portraying accurately what happens in a court case, in any case, criminal defense especially. But, you know, this idea that, oh, somebody gets off on a technicality, is largely inaccurate, right? There might be those exceptional cases where that happens, but it's by and large not the accurate picture.
And yes, you're absolutely correct. Those are the exception, definitely not the rule. Right. And for those technicalities, they have to be gross. It's you and I went to the same law school. We had the same professors for criminal law, criminal procedure, and there's so many court precedents where even if this was a mistake was made, if circumstances still would have led to it inevitably anyway, it's still good. Things like that.
And that's an important thing to remember is that, technicalities, everybody gets up in arms about it, but it's really a rare instance. And unfortunately, those rare ones are the ones that make the press, right? Like that's the ones that, the boring everyday, oopses and things that nobody cares. Nobody reports on that. So what unfortunately is this bias that create that's created in the media for the more extreme and absurd, circumstances. It's the same thing with jury verdicts, right? Like, you don't hear about the $100,000 cases or the $75,000 cases. You only hear about the $1 million cases, and that's an important thing to remember is that what you see is not necessarily an accurate representation. So, being a criminal defense attorney has some interesting dynamics to it as far as being a business owner is concerned. Because, and why is that? What creates that interesting?
Well, in part, any attorney is a service provider ultimately. However, with criminal defense, you're helping somebody out on what was potentially the worst day of their life, more so than, say, an estate planner or maybe as far as family law, but they have to like you because effectively you're in a relationship with them for however long this case goes on. So not only do you have to be good at your job, competent, know all the steps to take, being able to leverage whatever with district attorney or the city attorney or the assistant US attorney, but this person has to like you, be comfortable with you, and that can be a challenge because even if they retain, they still may not necessarily trust you enough to tell you everything. And that's a big thing with criminal defense is they have to be honest with you. It's getting ambushed when you have one set of arguments to find out that they just massage some facts differently when you took on the case can change everything in a defensive theory.
Yeah, and I think that's a important thing to remember is that the more truthful you are with your attorney, the more likely you're going to have a positive outcome, right? Like,
Oh, in general, absolutely.
yeah, like this. Oh, I don't trust my attorney. If you can't trust your attorney, and that isn't to say that there aren't attorneys out there that aren't great, or not trustworthy. I'm not suggesting that we're all perfect and haven't done anything wrong, but generally speaking, you need to trust your attorney enough to be able to tell them the full truth, and make sure so that we can do our best for you. The more you hold from us, the harder it gets. So let's kind of shift gears a little bit from talking about criminal defense in that because, like I said, you wear multiple hats. And I want to talk about as a business owner, what are the struggles that you face that you've overcome? You're relatively new to having your own practice. And I say relatively because how long have you been practicing by yourself?
Burkhead Criminal Defense really just opened up July 1st of last year. I was still a contractor with another law firm for the next few months afterwards, but I left that firm in its entirety the middle of September, after which I've been on my own ever since.
So you've been almost a year in on your own, and I've having opened my almost 4 years, actually more than 4 years ago. I'm looking at almost 5 years now. I have different problems than you do, right? Like I've been in business a little while, so I have different issues. What sort of issues have you been facing as you started something as difficult as criminal defense attorney
Well,
practice?
first off, was just setting up the business in the first place. I took the business organizations class in law school that tells you like how to incorporate. And that part's easy. That's just paperwork. And I talked to you a number of times about this. But past that, being an attorney, you then have to register as a law corporation, which was a whole other set of things. Like I had to make a stock certificate. In what world would I have ever had to make a stock? So, and some of it was just things like that. The other thing was worrying about being able to manage overhead. Sorry, I tend to swing with my pen a lot.
No, that's okay.
But like trying to manage overhead and keep costs down. And that's a huge thing, especially when you're first breaking out on your own and you're not walking in with a pile of clients. You know, fortunately, when I left my previous firm, I had about half a dozen clients come with me, and thus their client fees migrated with. So that helped. But from there, I still have to figure out advertising on how to, you know, attract new clients past just word of mouth referrals. And again, just all the overhead that's all over the place. I mean, you don't think about it, but you know, an Adobe subscription, and attorneys use Adobe all the time. I mean, that's $15 a month minimum. An Office 365 subscription. Like, there's you, as a new startup business, especially within the attorney field, like you get nickeled and dimed on so many different software packages that you don't think about because every other employer provided them, but you really need them.
And I think, you know, that's an important part of recognizing the difference between a business owner and an employee, right? Like as an employee, you just show up to work and you're expected to perform, and you know, things are provided for you. And if you need something, typically good employers, not always, but will provide the extra thing that you need, or they'll tell you no, whichever. But you know, as your own boss, you have to go out and find out what works for you best, and you know, what's cost effective, and then make those types of decisions as well. And you mentioned something else that I wanted to talk about, marketing, because criminal defense is not an easy market, like, because there's a lot of competition for it. So what have you done to differentiate yourself between you and someone that's been in practice for, you know, 20 years?
Okay, that is a great question. excuse me. Well, first, one thing that differentiates me personally is that I have a 20-year police background, so that puts me in a good position to look at police reports and see where things aren't there, which, you know, as I said earlier, was part of the reason I went into criminal defense. So I, with very little hyperbole, I think I'm a fantastic person to review your evidence and say, hey, here's a problem here, here's a problem here. On just the purely marketing side is I don't have the advertising budget. I'm not sitting on Google pay-per-clicks. I tried one of the paid providers that begins with an A. I think you know which one I'm talking about, and
Yeah,
I
I do.
was deeply unhappy with them. Canceled as soon as my initial contract was over. Felt like it was a waste of money. What I have had a lot more success with is A, I catch a lot of business from referrals. My customer and my clients tend to be very happy with the results I get them. And they're the first person to say, hey, this happened to you, call my guy. The other thing I do is I do some organic marketing, a lot of swag stuff. A lot of my business is DUI based, and generally misdemeanors, but I do handle felony DUIs. I obviously handle felony federal cases. So like one of the stupid things I did, and it sounds stupid, but like this little pen I keep playing around with, you know, it's got my company name, my phone number on it. It's metal, it's got a little heft to it. It's got a little rubber tip here. I give these to bartenders and waitresses just around all the restaurants and bars I know around here. And here's why. Most of them use a touchscreen POS. So they can use this and tap in orders and stuff without chipping their $60, $80 nails. They love it, but it also keeps my name in their head. So, and bartenders especially, you know, they'll get customers saddling up at the bar asking for whatever and start complaining about, hey, I just got a DUI on that. Well, the first name that they're thinking about then is me. I've managed to keep my name in their head. The other thing I do is I do bar coasters with my logo, my contact information. On the back, it has a QR code that just will directly add my contact card into your phone. Same thing, I market those out to a lot of bars. And especially, I think it was probably about 6 months ago, there was a shortage on bar coasters. So mine were sometimes the only ones a bar had for weeks. And that was just right time, right place. But those, you know, those I've had some good success with. And really, between these pens and those bar coasters, that is less than $600 worth of, you know, sunk cost. I've made more than 10 times that in returns on it.
Nice.
And yeah, like I have another version of my bar coasters going out. My marketing person, which it's my wife, so I don't pay her anything.
Well, you do, you just don't fare in the same way.
Yeah, exactly. But we did a redesign based on feedback I got from some of my bartenders. I just did a test batch, just ran it by, the eight or so bartenders I'm really in good with. And they love it. We're just waiting to put the order in. Then the next batch goes out. We'll see how the return on that is. The other big thing is networking.
Sure.
And that's all attorneys, but like with criminal defense, it's like I said, I'm a newer practitioner as a soloist or a solo practitioner. I tend to meet a lot of older attorneys that want to handle more bigger felony cases, things that have much more sizable retainers than say, the typical $2,500, $3,000 DUI.
Right.
So, I get in with them and they'll contract with me to take it at a reduced rate. So I wouldn't get, say, that whole 2,500, but if I take it for roughly half, okay, it's less money up front for me, but I'm also not carrying the advertising budget on.
Right.
And these are the older practitioners that do have the Google pay-per-click, the Google might, the better presences on social media, so on and so forth. So it's, right now I've been very grassroots and a lot of word of mouth, and just both on the client side and on the other attorney side, but I'm really starting to see the returns on that.
Awesome. So I wanted to kind of unpack a little bit about what you talked about, because you preach on, and I talk about this in my podcast and to people in general. But number one, you're going where your ideal client is, right? Like if you're talking about DUIs, and I've heard other DUI defense attorneys do beer bottle openers as well as coasters. So one that people keep, the other they may or may not. So I'm not suggesting you have to switch it up. I'm just saying I've heard other things working as well. But you're going where your ideal client is, right? Like you're not trying to go to, I mean, theoretically you could go to the high-end bars and do that, and I'm sure you might, but I'm talking like, maybe the top of the Hilton isn't the place that where you're going to be getting in at, right? You're going to more local establishments, people that have regulars, things of that nature, versus top of the Hyatt is more of a celebration one time. People are going to be a little more likely to hire an Uber, a Lyft, that type of thing to get them to and from there, where it's at downtown, as opposed to where we're talking about with you're talking about local bars where that's where people are going to go on a regular basis.
And actually, to get a little more granular on that, what I have been finding is the more corporate bars, you use the Hilton as an example, but it's just the corporate bars tend to be more restrictive on, say, who they'll use coasters from. They'll use it from a beer vendor, but they
Right.
won't use it from, say, a local attorney. The neighborhood watering hole, that dive bar that you like going to, every third Thursday, yeah, they love me. I'm one of them.
Right.
I'm in the same small business category as they are. They have no problem with it. And plus, like I was saying 6 months ago, I filled a gap. They had a need for bar coasters. I had bar coasters.
Right. And that's a huge way of being, staying top of mind for people, right? Because at the end of the day, that's what matters, right? I mean, and especially in the service industry, where there are going to be people that aren't going to want to take certain cases and being able to pass them on to you. But more importantly, where can you that I don't know, how much does a bar coaster cost? Like 10 cents, 5 cents?
Per unit, I couldn't tell you. I would say the first batch of 1,000 I made probably cost less than right around $250.
Okay.
So that breaks down to what, about 2.5 cents a
Two and
piece,
a half cents a
maybe?
piece, one client, is I mean, and how many coasters did you have to get in send out in order to get that
Well,
one
we'll
client?
say, I mean, it's the entire first batch pretty much went out over the course of a couple of months, and it was
Okay.
towards the tail end that the first couple of clients came in. So say out of that first batch, that 250 spent led to two retaining clients on actually DUIs.
Okay.
So average 2,500 a piece. Actual prices vary based off case specifics.
Sure.
That's $5,000 just on two coasters that worked. And one of those converted into a referral to another client, which I still kind of tag on because had I not had the bar coaster in the first place, I
Right.
would have had that first client. So that referral then counts against my ROI as I look at the bar coasters.
Right. So momentum plays a big role in that, right? Like, because you have to get that one and then that second, and then it's gonna snowball, right? Like, that's really what we're talking about here.
It is. I mean, there's a big piece of it where you have to treat the client right in the first place.
Oh,
I mean, you
sure.
could be competent, but if they if ultimately they don't like you, they may
Right.
trust you, but they just may not like you. They're not going to pass that referral on.
Right,
They're going to be
exactly.
like, this guy did an okay job, but eh.
Yeah.
And that's like with me, client care is a huge part of my business. I had another attorney call me a hand holder, and all I could say is, yep, you're absolutely correct.
Right.
Because that's what the client needs at that moment.
And I think that's a very valid perspective, is knowing your client and knowing what works for you. One of the things that I have on YouTube a video, 7 signs you've hired a bad attorney and what you can do about it. And
I do
I
follow
get,
you on YouTube.
yeah, I get tons of comments on there asking about this problem or that problem, or some attorney did this or some attorney didn't do that. And by and large, that's the number one complaint I get, are people that are frustrated because attorneys aren't communicative, right? Which tracks with what the bar has most complaints about, is when attorney takes the money and then doesn't fulfill their role or doesn't fulfill it to the way that they want. And I'm not saying every client has reasonable expectations, right? Some of them are way more demanding than others. But at the end of the day, we need to match our client needs and expectations as close as possible, as time permits, as we permit. I mean, we can't, and I've often said this, to my clients, is you're not my only client, right? Like, I have multiple clients, so I can't spend hours upon hours upon hours with on your matter when I have other clients that I have to work with as well too. I can't, like, I'm one person, I can't do that. But I should be spending enough time on that matter to make sure that they feel that we're handling it sufficient and that it's doing the right thing. And I wanted to breach on that because I think that's so important. Like, small businesses, where you have more time than money, it's important to use that time wisely to helping clients, or helping your customers, whichever. Once you get to the threshold where you have more money than time, then you need to start expanding your business into growing it to having other people to take up those gaps, right? Those things that you could be paying somebody to do eventually, but you weren't yet. Let me ask you, marketing. You were talking about coasters. Are there any other things besides networking and coasters that have been working for you?
Well, the pens. I mean, it's word of mouth referrals. I mean, I do spend a fair bit of time networking. Again, I always come back to this because it's so important in this industry. But even just to go to a random bar, sit down, have a beer, strike up a conversation with the bartender or whatever, and not necessarily to drop pens there, but just to feel out the customer base. And it's as an attorney, if I'm someplace strange and somebody hears I'm an attorney, somebody's gonna have a question, and this has to happen to you and every other attorney. Hey, can I ask you about this?
Yeah.
Once you start that dialogue and you don't trip over the line of giving legal advice, you give them a business card, maybe they call, maybe they don't. And that's more the social networking than the business networking. My other efforts, like I said, I tried a paid marketing service. We that was not happy with the outcome there at all. It just seemed to be a huge black hole of money, with very little return. A lot of tire kicking,
Right.
a lot of calls that were outside my practice area. That just, it's
Yeah.
a, yeah, and it ends up just being a time burn.
So I think that that's valid, and that's worth talking about a little bit more, is that, we have people that are marketing to us, right? And some are going to be better than others. And it's about, okay, and I know the company because they've pitched me for months and years at this point. And I had to, one of the benefits of being in a lot of lawyer groups that I'm in, we ask questions of each other. Did you try this? Have you tried that? And so a lot of them have already said, nope, had terrible results from companies like that. And so, word gets around. And I think it's important for, whether if you're in a niche market like attorneys, where we're, we all have different practice areas, but we all have similar needs, right? That you go where your fellow entrepreneurs are. You go, you network with the right people. Like, there's two sides to the networking. There's your ideal client, and then there's the people that can refer you people. But it's important to remember that you're balancing those two, right? Because I know that I've saved thousands of dollars by listening to other people that have had to actually, unfortunately, spend those thousands of dollars to find out that they were bad, potential bad investments. And so, and they're all very happy to share. So I think you bring up a couple of very interesting points in that respect, to have a fair, networking on both sides, right? What networking have you done besides bars, in the professional field? And there's nothing wrong with that. As a criminal defense attorney, that's where you got to go, where things are, the pens,
Add restaurants,
and
just end
restaurants.
bars with add restaurants at the end of all of that.
Okay, perfect. But as far as like professional networking, where do you go to meet your people that refer clients to you?
Well, I mean, at professional networks, I'm part of the County Bar Association, so San Diego County Bar Association. I'm on, the criminal law or criminal defense bar, member of the military law bar, just pretty much even the alternative dispute resolution bar. And they all have their own events, and it's a chance to meet other attorneys in either practice field or related fields. Past that, I'm part of the California Lawyers Association. Obviously a member of the state bar itself. More recently, because of my military service, I finally joined the VFW, Veterans of Foreign War. And granted, I am a newer member, but they seem to love having me there. It's, you know, every time I'm there, I meet some other new veteran, and they always want at least one business card. And it's, what I see with when I hand out cards, just to divert over for just a second,
Sure.
it's almost never the person I give the card to. It's
Right.
always someone they know. It's a child, a grandchild talking about the older veterans. If it's somebody I meet in the bar, it's not them, it's their buddy. It's
Right.
the same with the pens. I don't think the bartenders are the ones getting the DUIs. It's
No.
the customers they're seeing. So, and I mean, it's an interesting observation.
Right.
It seems to have held up so far, though. The other thing, you talked about the Facebook groups, and yeah, you and I are in a lot of the same Facebook groups.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, with the experience I was talking about, I was already in that contract
Yeah.
before I was a member of that group, because specifically that service came up and it got destroyed.
Yep.
Which, had I known, that would have saved me about a couple thousand dollars over the course of a few months. So.
Absolutely. And that's the important part, but here's the benefit to this. You lived, number one. As painful as it can be, you learned, and that's probably the next most valuable part. And number three, you're going to be a lot more discretionary with your funds, as far as especially in a marketing advertising perspective. You're going to spend the time and energy finding what works for you. That has more value, right? And I think that that's, one of the things I talk about to my listeners and people on podcasts is that business ownership is an iterative process. It's not something that you are going to be walk into, get right, and you're going to be successful the whole entire time, right? You're going to have failures. You're going to have moments where you're like, what the flip am I doing? And but the important part is that you just keep learning. You keep trying. You keep going. And it's hard. Like, anybody that says that entrepreneurship is easy, is selling you something, right? Like, they're trying to tell you to sign up for their thing. There's no easy. It's flexible, right? Like, I can work so many hours during the day and then have off evenings sometimes, or I can work, you know, a few hours in the morning and then take the afternoon off if I need to, but then I have to work at night to get it done. So each scenario, depending on where you're at in your business, is different. Tell me about your lifestyle, how being an entrepreneur has helped or hurt you.
Okay. So, first, just my background. I'm married. I have been for, do not tell my wife, I have to think about this, it's hard, almost 10 years. But we have a 2.5-year-old. He's in daycare all day. So my wife also works from home. She has her office downstairs. What we're looking at is the background of my home office. So we take our kid to daycare every day, and she does her thing in her office. I do mine in mine. You know, the one thing I really enjoy about being able to set my own calendar and control what I do when I do it is, and this is going to sound weird, but going to Costco. So bear with, I got to explain this. So going to Costco at 10:30 on a Wednesday morning, no matter how big your list is at best a 45-minute trip.
Yeah.
The place is almost empty. It's a lot of retirees. It's a few, you know, stay-at-home moms or shift workers. But, it, you know, compare that to any given point during the weekend where that same trip is minimum 2 hours, if not longer. And just being able to save, say, for example, that hour and 15 minutes, not deal with the crowds, not have to sit in line forever, that's huge to me. I don't do well just standing around waiting. I tend to be a very mentally active person. That's why, if you haven't noticed, I tend to fidget a lot, and it's not fidgeting. It's just, I'm very kinetic.
Right.
And so standing in line, waiting, like all of that is just internally maddening to me. So, I mean, and that's just one example. You know, the other thing is, you know, with the personal care, being able to, you know, arrange when I do things based off of my needs, if I have to go to the doctor, the dentist, optometrist, you know, any medical care, same thing with my son. It's, I can arrange court dates notwithstanding.
Right.
I can generally arrange client time, paperwork time, admin time, so on and so forth, around whatever the immediate needs of my family are. And that's huge. And especially where, you know, being my own boss, I can ask my boss permission, but I guarantee I'm going to say yes.
Right.
And like you said, it's sometimes you do have to make it up on the back end. So I, you know, there are times, depending on the caseload and what's going on, that, you know, I may work till 10, 11 midnight, just because there's that much going on. But whatever I had to pause for during the day was more important overall.
Right.
I did find a good trick with that though, because you don't want people thinking you work that late. So if you're going to send it, if you're going to start responding to emails, most email services will allow you to delay send to a certain time. So
yeah,
just chamber those emails, mark them to send at, and don't do it at 8, don't do it at 8:15, don't do it at a regular time. Have them sent at like 8:09. Because if you're always replying to something at 8 a.m., people kind of figure it out after a while.
Right.
8:09 is just off enough time that nobody questions it.
Yeah. I think that's so important too, like, and especially in a field where we are, you know, people unfortunately expect that we have no life and we're on demand at points, and balancing expectations, right? That's really what that's talking about, making sure that people respect our time. That's one of the reasons why, like, I use an answering service, right? Because my time is valuable enough that, and I'm not suggesting my client's time isn't valuable. It's so valuable that I want to be able to give a dedicated amount of time to it. And especially when I'm working on a matter and someone's paid me to work on that matter, isn't it more important that I'm devoting that time to that than answering the phone for some sales call, getting distracted,
oh, yeah,
and then getting back to the matter eventually? Versus spending the appropriate amount of time on it and then ending up that, you know, frustrated at the end because I didn't accomplish the thing that was needed in that respect. And I think that's wise about the emails too, because, you know, you do get a lot of late night stuff from people. I know I do. And it's a real, like, you can either schedule an email to go out or you can... save it in your drafts and send it when you've, you know, the next day if you don't have a way of scheduling it.
Let's say I was gonna say, I have noticed like Outlook, Gmail, they all have like timed sends, and you can specify to the minute. What you were saying about like you have an answering service, like I'm not so evolved yet that I can justify that expense. But the problem, like you were saying, with sales calls, if my phone rings, I have to answer it because any call could be a new client, and the caller ID for a lot of these vendors shows up as somebody's name. These days, since most people use cell phones, it doesn't matter what the area code is on it. It's, and especially San Diego being a huge military town, I have clients that, well, military clients that, they're from Oklahoma. Their phone number is out of Oklahoma. For the 4 years they've been here, they have no reason to change their phone. But as my own, I'm my own back office too, I have to answer.
Well, and I would encourage you as soon as possible to pay for the receptionist, to have the virtual receptionist. And I say that because the amount of time that you save in not getting distracted from those sales calls, like your best use of time is working on legal matters, right? Like that's where you're making your money at, not answering your phones, right? So it, what would you say like your average hour is? Like how much does that cost you?
Okay, so everything I do is on a flat fee. So I have memorandum that explain, because even on a flat fee, if you haven't exhausted all of it and you and the client part ways for resolution, they may still be due a refund. So internally, I have memorandum that put my billable between 200 to 250 an hour. Some cases, I'm involved with a small business incubator through our old law school, ALI. You know this. And part of the requirement for that was you have to take more what we call low boto clients. They need an attorney, they can't afford $300+ an hour. You have to meet them somewhere, on the cheaper side of things. My general rate internally is 250 an hour, which is just about average for a San Diego attorney with my level of experience. That rate will increase over a couple of years, but so yeah, I guess the easiest answer is 250 an hour.
So, depending on the virtual receptionist, right? Like I pay. Well, I use what's called Smith AI, and there's lots of different services out there. There's Ruby, there's Smith AI, Lex Reception, and well, I'm not going to tell you which one to pick, but they have plans starting at $300 an a month for depending on the number of calls that they take. Some of them are done by minute, and some of them are done by per call. Smith is done per call, so I get 30 calls per month. But what is nice about Smith, and again, I'm not trying to push you into Smith. I'm not, it's your call. I'm not going to tell you what to do. But the sales calls and spam calls don't count against that quota, that number. So while it's 30 actual calls that they bill me for at approximately $10 per call, and there's no time, right? They don't charge me based on time. They charge me based on call. So there's no incentive for them to get off the phone with the person or to spend as much time as humanly possible with them, and spend that time there. My point is if you can bill essentially one extra hour per month because of not getting interrupted because of sales calls, or if you can make one more extra connection that nets in a client, right? One of the big things is what if you're out of the office and you can't take that phone call, right? And that's someone that people hate leaving voicemails, and especially criminal defense. They want you and they want you now, right? They don't want to wait. They don't want to wait to talk to you. They'll literally go down the shows you how old I am. I was about to say the yellow pages or the phone book.
Age appropriate.
Yeah, they'll go down the phone book and they'll just keep going until they find somebody that picks up the phone. Well, if you can't be there, then that one client that could have hired you isn't going to hire you, right? And you calling them back, while beneficial, you're most likely going to get a voicemail, right? And you're going to leave your message, which is great. Not suggesting not to do that. But they would have already have talked with somebody, and that somebody would have already hired them, right? Or potentially could have hired them, and they feel that. So you can't look at it as, oh, it's an expense I can't justify. I can tell you right now that you can fill that expense without much difficulty. And I mean, like, literally, my business has improved drastically by having them on here. That's like a mandatory expense for me. It's one of those ones that I'll find a way to pay it even in the months that I don't have it, because of how beneficial it is to getting that. And I can focus on things like developing, you know, more value-based things, right? Like, if I'm focusing on my client matter, that has more value to me than focusing on answering the phone for, like, for instance, I had a client or a potential client last night call and ask to borrow money because they needed it for legal fees. And, like, if that would have been a phone call that I took, right, that's just weird to call an attorney and ask them for money to do that. But my receptionist picked it up, and I've had other phone calls where they pick up after hours, where I'm not in the office, and then it gets picked up the next day, and I'm able to really nail down the people that I want to work with, rather than that risk that you're taking that you can't pick up the phone, and then all of a sudden, oh, there just went $1,000 or there went $2,000 out your door that you could have had for that one month, right? So anyway, my point in telling you that
I gotta back up.
Sure.
I have to back up a second. So you had a client call to borrow money for legal fees. Was this to pay you?
No. This was, okay. This was weird. Like, it was a weird phone call. But yeah, it was like, really? Who calls an attorney to borrow money to pay for legal fees? Like, I don't do that type of law. But more to the point, I'm not a bank. I'm not judging people that choose to do this, but I'm not a bank. But my overall point is, you know, spending your time on that. So on things that generate money, and then letting things like phone calls get answered by somebody else, that's what they do. And, you know, get back to the people, you know, as quick as possible, right? But at the same time on your schedule. What kind of tools do you use? Besides, we talked about Office 365. We talked about Adobe Premiere membership. Besides that, do you use any type of client relationship manager?
Well, as part of Access to Law Initiative, I have a year of Clio, which is practice management software.
Sure.
It's good for what it is, but I'm not so saturated with clients that I see the value in using it versus just using, say, OneDrive as a filing system. It's what I'm seeing is it takes more time to input everything than it's saving me on the back end. And that's just, I think, at this state of my business. You know, obviously, if the client pool swells up, especially after this episode posts, then, you know, it maybe I can justify continuing with it. You know, there's things I like about it. I've used practice management software in other firms. You know, right out of law school, I ended up in civil litigation as a law clerk while I was waiting for bar results. So I was under their practice management software, and it's good. And I see where it had, you know, I worked insurance defense for one of the top four insurance companies, and they have their own special practice software, and everything had to be in that. And it makes sense because they're dealing with thousands of cases.
Right.
Where, you know, here right now, at most, I may have 30 active cases.
Right.
Just the ebb and flow of how cases, you know, come in and adjudicate. And obviously I want those numbers to go up. So I don't see the value in it at the moment, but I see as I expand where that may be a more necessary evil.
Sure.
The other thing I do use is I do have access to LexisNexis, which for the audience that may not be attorneys listening to this, that is basically it's almost like Yahoo for legal research.
Right.
If you call Westlaw Google, it's Yahoo. It's almost just as good, arguably better in some ways. But it's basically a legal database. You can get access to cases. They help with citations. You can actually go in and pull old filings from other cases because, you know, if you're filing a motion, you don't necessarily want to have to reinvent the wheel. You go find something similar, right. Make sure it's still relevant. And I'm not saying you copy it wholesale, but it does help guide you into your own authorship.
Right.
And that is a huge time saver. With criminal defense, generally though, if something isn't going as far as trial, and 99% of cases never see trial, they're usually pled out, and even on a misdemeanor, they're usually pled out in probably three, four hearings tops. It's the value even on Lexis is limited to just those things that move forward to trial, and where you actually do have to file, say, motions to suppress evidence, or offer to set aside the information being the actual charges they're facing at trial. So, but like I do have some, actually do have potentially a felony trial coming up, and I see where I'm going to get a lot of value out of that Lexis subscription in a couple months.
Nice.
So.
So there is actually a difference between a practice management, which is CLIA, which you talked about, and what I was referring to, a client relationship manager. And that's okay. I wasn't clear on that one. I use it's called Lawmatics, and it keeps all of my clients and all of my information for my clients in there. So that I can use it, and it has marketing automation. It has things. It actually is trying to move to full blown practice management software, but it started out as basically an intake software. And the reason why I bring that up is because there's traffic that you buy. There's free traffic, and then there's traffic you own. Okay, and one of the things that only 3% of the people that contact you at any given point, depending on who they are and where they're at in their case, are ready to hire. Okay. There's a large percentage of the population that are contacting you that are nowhere near ready to hire. And so, what a client relationship manager does, or CRM, allows you to maintain a relationship with that potential client, to follow up with them, to hopefully move them from the basket of, maybe, to, yeah, I want to hire you. And because following up is key, there are so few attorneys that follow up with active clients or potential active clients that one of the ways that you can improve your practice is simply by following up with the clients or potential clients that you get. And there's a lot of issue that people will pay large amounts of money and then never follow up. And especially true in like pay-per-click, PPC. A lot of attorneys will pay huge amounts of money, and then somebody contacts them, and rather than following up, it's like, oh, they contacted me once, therefore, they're going to continue to follow up, right? They're interested in me, so I don't have to do any work. The problem is that people get busy, people forget, and when it's not pressing on their mind enough to call you, they get sucked into their own problems and that aren't related to the law matter that you're working with, and they just don't follow up back with you. And so one of my mentors, Andy Stickle, talks about following up with someone 3 times in 3 weeks. So when a client calls in, you follow up with them via phone call, via text, via email, on different, spread it out because you never know what they're busy with and what they're doing. But by doing that, you're meeting the client, and this is important for any business. This isn't just related to law. You're meeting the client or customer where they are, right? Because you're being the person that's not necessarily pursuing them, but you're giving them that you're interested in them. It's a lot like a dating relationship, right? If a girl only contacts you and you never contact them back, then you're going to not have a relationship, right? And so the key in that instance is that you need to follow up. You need to contact people back. I've contacted 2 different potential vendors for my law practice that I needed help with in the last couple of weeks, and not one of them out of those two has followed up with me. And one of them is a family member of an attorney. And it blew me away. I'm like, so you have enough business that you don't need to follow up with me? I put a legitimate thing on your website. And I mean, we're talking weeks here. We're not just talking like, ooh, the next day. And I'm like, maybe I'm not ready right now, or I actually was at the time. But you're telling me that you have enough work that you don't want more? I've never met anybody that that's true of, that there's not an opportunity. So Part of it is about not just about like, yes, they need to find you, but you need to find them too, right? And that's part of the process. So I would encourage you, that's the other thing I would recommend, is getting a client relationship manager to follow up with people and automate the heck out of it. Because you're one person and you can only do so much. And if you spend so much time following up, that you won't have enough time to actually do the work, right? Like that's part of the problem that you run into. And so automate what you can and keep consistent with what you have. So what nuggets of wisdom, like I want you to share with fellow entrepreneurs, people that are just getting started, they've been in business just a few months. What would you share with them that would give, what would you want to impart to them as your wisdom?
I mean, if I just quote a really old song, wear sunscreen. The long-term benefits of sunscreen are proven by scientists, whereas everything else I'm going to say is just based on my own meandering experience. Points if you know where that came from.
I don't actually, but that's
Baz
fair.
Luhrmann, but he actually took it from a graduation speech.
Okay.
Would have been summer of 99, I believe.
Okay.
So anyway, I'm waiting to work that in somewhere.
That's nice.
So, first thing, and you have it in your intro to the show is success, fail, try again. Don't be afraid of the failure. It's going to happen. Not everything works. I spent how much time complaining about this one marketing sector I tried, and it was just not
Right.
yielding results. Okay, that's a failure. But like you said, I learned from it. I'm a little more wary in dealing with other vendors now. So I mean, don't be afraid of the failure. And failing in part is not necessarily failure as a whole.
Yeah.
It's the black hole of that advertising money being gone. Okay, fine, whatever. It's just, I know I probably do better with my more grassroots organic marketing, the bar coasters, the pens. I always had a plan to do keychains. I was just looking for the cheapest entry point, and that one just happened to hit. So,
Right, right.
but like the keychains were on my list. I mean, what else? Understand upfront, unless you just if you're selling a product and it just happens to be the next best, what. Whatever it is, like that just sells out instantly. I can think of a couple Shark Tank things where that worked. If you're a service provider or you're just entering into the marketplace with another version of a product, you're going to have some really slow periods.
Right.
Try to have the money set aside to cover, when you have down months. For criminal defense, December and January tend to be fairly slower months. The courts slow down, they go dark over Christmas to New Year. Excuse me. Probably should have forewarned. The fun part of having a 2.5-year-old in school is you have nothing but hot and cold running colds around the house.
Yeah.
It's so, with me, I was lucky because I pulled clients over from my old firm, but I'm also a military retiree. I also have, VA benefits, plus a wife that makes enough money to keep us afloat. So even on those slow months, it's being able to manage your own expectations. But like I was saying with the courts, they go slow down over December and January. So even say a Thanksgiving DUI may not even first appear in court until almost February, late January.
Right.
Same thing. So I mean, there's. For DUI attorneys, there's a honeypot of Thanksgiving and Christmas and New Year's and eventually Super Bowl, all within this 3-month span. Most of it won't even start hearing in court until mid-February at the earliest.
Right.
So, but people, and I see this a lot in criminal defense, that people don't really necessarily think about getting an attorney until close to their court date.
Yeah.
If it's serious enough, they'll get it right out the bat. But if it's just a and forgive the expression, simple DUI, they will wait until a week or two before their first appearance and be like, okay, now I want to hire a lawyer. So, side note on that, especially with DUIs, there are very limited time frames. And for your audience base that may know people in this position. If somebody gets a DUI, they need to talk to an attorney the day they get out. Because right. even something like license suspension, if you don't request a hearing with the DMV within 10 days, you're suspended. You have no right to appeal that.
Wow.
Yeah, wow, and that's intense. But you get people say, yeah, but you say people on a Thanksgiving DUI, their first appearance isn't until January, late January. Well, hey, lo and behold, you've lost that 10-day window.
Right.
Your license is getting suspended. But if you hired somebody early, you get around it. But I digress.
Yeah.
You know, other wisdom, like I said, manage your own expectations. It's right. don't expect to be a rousing success right out the door. It takes time. It takes perseverance. You know, it's not for everyone. You have to be willing to say, hey, I'm not going to go on vacation this year. I'd rather reinvest in X, Y, or Z. Like you're, you know, trying to talk to me about like Smith AI, talk to me about Lawmatics, and they make sense. But, you know, for me to put the money into that, then I have to divert it off of something else. You know, it's, I don't pay myself on a salary. I pay myself on an equity draw. Apparently there's tax reasons for that. So, you know, that's, I can use the money one way or I can use it another way. I can't use it in both. $1 only goes in one direction.
True, but I want to kind of dispel a little bit of a thought on that one. I just want to say is that the time is the only resource that you can't get more of. You can always get more
sure.
money, right? So if you're investing in something that's saving you time, that value, that dollar, is worth more in that instance, right? We're not talking about things that like, I'm not suggesting buying new boats and cars and stuff of that nature, because that doesn't save you anything, right? That's just money spent.
Yeah.
Because the speed limit is the speed limit. There's a maximum there, right? But when we're talking about things for your law practice, and then this is true in business as well, is that the money that you spend on saving you time or your client's time, right? If you can do something better or faster and you can improve your quality, then you can handle more cases. Therefore, then you can fill in the blank, right? Like help more people. And then it's you're cutting down that and you're able to offer better fill in the blank faster. So while I understand the point of the dollar, don't get me wrong, I think it's important that, you know, investing in time-saving things has more value than just investing in stuff in some instances. So
oh,
continue.
And I agree with that. What else can I say? If you're going to do things like podcasts, get a good webcam. Don't trust the one that's on your computer.
Very true.
I am way newer to this than you are, so anything I'm going to say is severely limited by my own limited experiences.
That's okay. There's going to be people that I help all sorts of people from different things. So, like having this even a year in is useful, right? Because people sometimes can't even see that year. That's an important thing to remember.
Keep track of all of your expenses. Just in a general sense, because they all tend to be deductible, and you do have to do a little segregation here. Like my wife and I share a printer; it's technically mine, but you know, I give her joint custody of it. Mm-hmm. However, like I have certain reams. Like I go to Staples, I buy the box of paper. I sideline half of this paper is just for my cases,
right.
Because I can bill that. You know, that is a deductible expense. The other half is either for her and whatever she's printing for work or just general household use. But you have to be willing to put the time to manage that segregation because, you know, when it comes to deducting those expenses, the IRS can get really particular about it.
Right.
You know, like we were talking about service providers earlier, like I use QuickBooks. Right. And, you know, I used it. I got the self-employed because at the time I was just a contractor. But, like, it does a great job of tracking my mileage. So like if I'm going to a client meeting, I'm going to meet with another attorney, all of that is deductible mileage, but you have to accurately track it.
Right.
And like something like QuickBooks, the self-employed, and I'm not a paid plug for them, but it tracks all of that individually. I can assign it to a specific, like, here's why I was there, boom. And then monthly, annually, whatever, I can pull that report and say, here's my mileage, here's my business expenses.
Right.
You know, just everything. And that's a huge thing is, I can say like I was definitely profitable, my first 6 months in business because my income exceeded my expenses. And the reason I know this is because I could pull a simple report showing, hey, I made this much, I spent this much. And that's huge.
That is huge. And being profitable first year is huge. There's a lot of businesses that are not profitable for the first couple of years. And so it's important that you're recognizing that. But a lot of businesses also don't keep track of expenses or their income for that matter. So that's really important. So we're almost out of time, but before we go, I wanted to ask you a couple of fun questions just for my audience to get to know you and to kind of just for fun. So the first question is, would you rather be the best player on a horrible team or the worst player on a great team?
Okay, so I've answered this question in a number of different ways, and it goes to one of my general theories. I use a different example. I would rather be a little fish in a big pond because I have room to grow into it, than be the big fish in the small pond, i.e., being the best player on the horrible team, because where do you go from there? The other example I've always kind of grown up with is if you are the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room.
So true. If you that is so true. Surrounding yourself by smarter people helps elevate you, right? Like it helps you
Exactly.
improve your game, right? Like if you're in a basketball game, do you want to be in a basketball game with MJ? Or do you want to be in a basketball game with, oh, I don't even know who, I don't play basketball, but you get what I'm saying. It's just like,
Absolutely.
I mean, like, if I could play with Tom Brady, that would be a dream come true, right? Because who are you going to want to play with football wise, as opposed to, Philip Rivers. And I'm not suggesting, I mean, Philip Rivers has had talent, but he was on the Chargers, not on, he never won a Super Bowl. Would you rather win, play with Tom Brady, who's won seven Super Bowls, or would you rather play with Philip Rivers, who I don't even think he made it to a Super Bowl, if I'm not mistaken on that one. Yeah, don't
I'm
get
not
me
a native
started on the
San Diego,
Chargers.
so
Chargers,
that's
never mind. What is the weirdest thing you've ever eaten?
as a child, I was accused of leading my kindergarten class's Play-Doh eating ring, to the
That's
point
awesome.
where I apparently ended up to the doctor at the doctor to explain why certain things were certain colors. That's little kid stuff. As an adult, there's been some weird stuff on sushi I've eaten. I think the better answer is the weirdest thing I drank, and that is when I was stationed in Korea, they have a beverage over there called soju. Not really sure what's in it.
Oh boy.
It basically tastes like formaldehyde.
Wow.
And not to get too far into a diverted story, but it's the off-base bar I used to go to with a bunch of friends. They would serve it in what they would call like an ammo bowl. It was a bowl about this big. It had like 20 straws in it. There's six of us. We order one, look around after about half an hour. There's only two of us drinking it. I granted, I was not a, heavy drinker at the time, but that was a whole different level of drunk.
Oh my.
Oh no, my roommate and my other friends over there found me across the street trying to Spider-Man up a wall between two apartment buildings. Apparently, I was doing pretty good with it.
Oh boy.
So,
Oh, that's
yeah, it's
awesome.
I definitely drank way weirder things, not necessarily alcoholic, than probably eaten.
Gotcha. I've never, the most I've ever eaten, weird wise, and it's not even that weird, is escargot. And you put them in enough butter, garlic, sauce, and they taste like just chewy something. They're not even, there's really no taste to them. It's more the getting over the idea that it's escargot than it is the actual taste of them. They don't taste much like anything.
Yeah, same thing with frog legs.
I'm sure it is. All right, last but certainly not least, what happened on your worst date?
My worst date. So I told you the soju story. No, totally unrelated. Just short version. Girl I met on an online dating site years before my wife. Met her for dinner, doing the banter thing, and I have this story that I can't go into the whole thing now because I see we are running a little short on time, but Basically, my parents wanted me to eat Brussels sprouts. I refused, 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 went back and forth, back and forth. My dad's like, okay, well, you eat one Brussels sprout. And this is 8-year-old Jason. I'm like, okay, I'll eat one, then I can leave. He's like, yeah, let me go warm these up. So keep in mind, 8-year-old Jason. My dad comes out of the kitchen just a couple minutes later, and in place of the Brussels sprouts, he has an entire head of cabbage on this plate. In my 8-year-old brain, this is very traumatic. This is the one Brussels sprout he wants me to eat. Okay, that's the story. No, that's the story I tell to this date. And the rest of the date goes okay. You know, it's a couple drinks, shoot some pool, blah, blah, blah. We get to the end of the night, saying goodnight to her in her car, and she leans over and she's like, oh, by the way, I love Brussels sprouts. Last time I ever talked to her.
Oh my.
Like,
Oh
if
goodness.
that's the reason that
Yeah.
you don't want to call me back, I mean, probably better it ended that way.
Probably. I have some stories of which I can't go into in the spec that they're too long, but had a girl that I went to Las Vegas to meet on my 24th birthday, and she ditched me to see the Blue Man Group. My prom story was I borrowed a stick from a friend to drive because my parents' car wasn't very good, and I didn't know how to drive stick very well, and so I stalled it the whole night. That was I like I. They used to have competitions on the radio where for worst prom ever, and I probably could have won if I would have been old enough at the time to do that. But I digress. So I've had some fun dates that I'm grateful that I found my wife, and I'm grateful that I don't ever have to worry about dating again, because that was not my favorite when it came to that. So, Jason, it's been so great having you on here. Thank you so much for your time. If people are interested in reaching out to you, how can they find you, or where can they find you?
Okay, so first, Taylor, thank you for having me on. People can find me on Facebook at Burkhead Criminal Defense. That's my business page. I'm still developing content on it. I know you have opinions on that too.
I do.
I'm on the web at www.burkheadcriminaldefense.com, or they can call me direct at 619-663-6660. Realize that is a lot of sixes.
That is a lot of sixes, but easier to remember. That's good. That's always good.
It is.
So thank you so much, and we'll talk to you next time. So thank you.
Great. Thank you, Taylor.
So that was Jason Burkhead, and he is a friend of mine from law school. We had the opportunity to, he graduated slightly after me and has been on his own, and I've been helping him with his practice to help grow and develop it. And it's something that I enjoy doing because at the end of the day, helping him helps all of us, right? We need people that want to be in business for themselves and that can provide a living for themselves. And Jason brought up some very great information. It's important that your flexibility is one of your benefits to being an entrepreneur. So to use that adequately, don't get sucked into the mindset of I have to work, 70, 80 hours a week in order to be successful. That's simply not true. There might be weeks where that is true, but it shouldn't be the average, shouldn't be the norm. You should be getting adequate rest. You should be doing things that help and benefit your life so that you can be your best. Don't forget that when in an emergency, they talk about putting on your mask first. That in a plane, if the cabin pressure gets messed up, that you should put on your mask first. And that's so true in the entrepreneur world, is that you need to be able to take care of yourself so that you are able to be your best for when you are needed to be that best. Thank you so much for joining me. And as always, think tactically about your business and have a great week.